Hello and welcome to this Jack Radio documentary special. My name's Daniel Seed and I'm joined in the studio by Maya Fellows. Hello, Maya.
Hi, Dan.
On today's show, we're showcasing just a small number of the short radio documentaries created by Journalism in Sound students here at the University of Queensland in 2016. At the recent Inspire Festival held in Brisbane, veteran radio broadcaster Robin Bailey made a comment on audio documentaries when she said, "I have no interest in bugs. I've never had an interest in bugs. But I listened to a documentary on a man who loved bugs, and for 50 minutes, I did too." This is the power of radio, drawing us into people's narratives in a very personal way. Telling stories is what radio excels at. It uses the human voice to create a link between people who may never have met and who may live on opposite sides of the world. Each of the stories we're playing for you today offers a brief 5-minute window into the lives of some extraordinary people and says a lot about the power of these types of radio pieces. Radio documentaries, in contrast to a news bulletin, give people the chance to tell their stories in their own voices. It opens a door to you to come into their lives, even if just for a short amount of time. We have a fantastic hour of radio ahead of us, exploring a wide range of topics. Today, we'll be playing 7 short documentaries from our journalism students, and first up is one from Kurt Enkerer. Maya, can you tell me about this one?
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Well, our first story is by Kurt Enkerer on red skin syndrome. It's a topic that doesn't receive very much media attention, and I wanted to find out why Kurt chose to tell a story on this particular topic.
I've been wanting to do a story on red skin syndrome for a while now, but in the past, I haven't really been given the opportunity to do so. This radio documentary task, we were given a lot of freedom. And particularly, the main thing for me was being able to interview my mum. You know, especially with a lot of university assignments for journalism, where, you know, we're not allowed to interview close family friends or relatives or, you know, whatnot. But I grabbed this opportunity with both hands and... But also being an issue that this red skin syndrome, it doesn't really receive a lot of media attention. And after my interview with Dr. Chris Reynolds, I learned that it's not even formally acknowledged as a proper medical condition in academic literature. So basically, I really wanted to bring this issue to life, and I knew that I could do this given the freedom and given the power of radio and sound.
Being a journalist means you have to interview all types of people, from politicians to medical researchers. But when you interview a member of your immediate family, it can be very difficult. Let's see what Kurt had to say about interviewing his mother.
Interviewing my mum was very challenging and very different. And by that I mean I went into the interview with 0 questions because I wanted the interview to unfold as naturally as possible. And I felt that if I just, you know, went in with a set of questions, it wouldn't be as effective as simply talking, from a mother to son, you know, and that's what I did. That was very hard for her to talk about all of that, you know, trauma that she'd been through, and she got very emotional, and as you can see in my piece, she breaks down. And, you know, when she got emotional, I got emotional. I had to look away from her. And at that point, I really wanted to just go and give her a big hug. But I had to stop myself because I just wanted the interview to flow naturally. And I'm thankful that I just remained silent.
I really enjoyed listening to this radio documentary, and I hope you do too. It's the first of many great packages that we'll be showing you during this special. Let's listen to Kurt's documentary on red skin syndrome.
It pains me to see her in such discomfort. I knew her condition was bad. We had briefly talked about it over the phone before, but I never imagined it would be like this. I'm visiting my mother, Lee Enkerer, for the first time in several months at her home at Glasshouse Mountains, watching her vacuum thousands of skin flakes off her bedsheets. Mum is battling red skin syndrome, a debilitating but little known side effect of topical steroid use. She began using topical steroid creams 33 years ago under the advice of her GP to treat a small rash. While her skin improved, it would inflame whenever she tried going cold turkey. 8 months ago, after learning that the topical steroids were causing the inflammation all along, she stopped using them for good. The following months have been a living nightmare.
I had big swollen legs and feet from coming off the steroids. And when I went for a run, it was like running with elephant legs. I could hardly squeeze into my running shoes. And probably shouldn't have been running at all, but it's like my sanity saver. And then I think when I got to about 4 months, that's when it was at its worst. Like, my body was just oozing almost everywhere. My feet, my ankles, my face, behind my ears, my neck, my hands, my elbows.
Her skin also developed a permanent itch she described as bone deep, causing many sleepless nights. To distract her from the agony, she would watch pre-recorded renovation shows, sometimes until the early hours of the morning.
When you go to bed and you itch and you just keep tossing and turning till the sun comes up and you still haven't slept. And it's kind of a horrible feeling, so that you actually end up feeling a bit scared to go to bed because you just think, oh my God, am I just going to toss and turn and not sleep again?
Last month, Mum sought out the medical expertise of Dr. Chris Reynolds, a local medical practitioner who has specialised in treating red skin syndrome for more than 20 years. He advised her to use his uniquely formulated wheatgrass skin recovery spray, which he says has helped hundreds of suffering patients around the world. She has since noticed some improvements.
In that time, I noticed that I've stopped. What you have is this Chinese burn kind of feeling over your whole body, and by the evening that seemed like even worse. It's kind of like a bit like when you get sunburned, you know, you're really at your worst in the evening. So I've noticed that Chinese burn feeling's gone, and when you roll over in bed at night, it's not sore anymore. It's quite nice, a lot more comfortable. And the itching is far less. You know, sometimes the itching was so intense. just really stressful. Sorry. It's just really, really hard. It's been like hell. I try not to look back because it's hell.
Mum resents the pharmaceutical industry for not issuing strong warnings of the traumatic side effects that accompany topical steroid use.
I think I blame pharmaceutical companies for wanting to be more interested in making money out of selling their product than having warnings, like very intense warnings to people who use these products of what could happen.
Dr. Reynolds says topical steroid creams will continue to be administered by medical practitioners at the detriment of patients so long as they remain profitable for pharmaceutical companies. At the same time, effective treatments like wheatgrass, which cannot be patented in its natural form, will continue to be overlooked.
It's a trap for young doctors. It's a trap for old doctors too, because they've got nothing else. If there was something like the grass that would help, but that's not going to help Big Pharma. Pardon my cynical view of this, but you know, they're talking about shareholders. I'm talking about patients.
While my mum feels as though her worst days are behind her, her partner Warren is prepared for another flare-up.
I guess the frustration is that there's no evidence of it being a steady improvement. It's kind of roller coaster, and sometimes it just doesn't look like it's getting any better.
Dr. Reynolds insists persistent use of his wheatgrass spray will allow Mum to eventually make a full recovery. Exactly how long it will take, however, is unknown, such as the nature of her condition.
That was Red Skin Syndrome by Kurt Enkerer. What did you think, Dan?
Look, I've been in a position myself where I've had to watch my own mum suffer through substantial health problems before she passed away. There's a helplessness in a moment where parents move from being the carers to the cared for. That can be a really hard moment in any family dynamic. It can be particularly difficult, I suppose, when children take on that caring role earlier than maybe conventional. For Courtney's mum to speak about this and record their conversations is an incredibly brave thing to do. It certainly opens up a conversation about the relationship between doctors and patients and the pharmaceutical industry. There's no easy answer there. It's certainly something discussed frequently around strong medications, such as the steroid cream talked about in this story, or drugs used in palliative care or cancer treatments, for example. The piece we've just listened to from Kurt there is really powerful in the fact that it doesn't end in a solution. There isn't a nice, satisfying bookend to the story. That's a reality for so many people with chronic health conditions and their families. It sounds a bit cliched to say that raising awareness is important, but it truly can make people at the very least feel more understood and not feel like they have to explain themselves to the rest of the world.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you say that, because when I spoke with Kurt, he actually said that this story made him feel more at ease, and he was happy to find out that it's not the be-all and end-all for his mother with having this condition. But what's the next story that you've got for us, Dan?
So the next piece is definitely something we can all relate to at some point, but perhaps not in the way that Kate Lockwood experienced. The occasional sleepless night can bring on anxiety, stress, anger, frustration. Getting a good sleep is pivotal to every part of our lives. It can impact on the way we learn, the way we work. It can affect our health, both mentally and physically. But what would you do if those sleepless nights became more and more frequent? What if, no matter what you tried, it just didn't work? How long would it take you to go looking for help? Despite everything she could think of, at one point, Kate was awake continuously for several days. This story explores the processes we've all been through at some point or another, staring at the ceiling, willing sleep to come. We spoke to documentary maker Maxwell Rowley about making this piece. This is what he had to say.
It was a really tough process putting the doco together. I've listened to a lot of documentaries before on like This American Life and all sorts of podcasts. And so I guess I had a kind of understanding of how they were put together. But then actually doing it myself, I honestly had no idea what to do. I fiddled around with a lot and I tried to find some good music to fit the theme. And I think once I had that music, then I could sort of layer different bits over it. And that got the ball rolling. I think the doco for me, I actually would have liked to have had a kind of more uplifting end. But I think the take home message is about changing perspective and looking at stresses around uni and those sorts of things and really putting them into perspective and seeing them for what they are. Because I think it's a story that would resonate with a lot of students who can get really stressed and lose a lot of sleep over things. But really, in the end, it's not everything. It doesn't really matter when it comes to your health. And
this next piece from Max Rowley is called Good Night and Good Luck.
I know that I'm a bit prone to like stress. That's definitely true. But I never really imagined that it was physically possible to just stop sleeping.
Awake. Still. The hours slowly creeping by. Thoughts whirling round and round your head, willing sleep to come. We've all been there. We've all had a sleepless night. Around 10% of people have at least mild insomnia, and most will experience insomnia symptoms at some point in their lives. But few have been through what Kate Lockwood had to endure.
There was a day where I just became convinced I might never sleep again, which is ridiculous, but seemed so real at the time.
It was after her medical entry examinations that Kate broke down. The stress and anxiety finally took its toll, and she spent 3 full days and nights without a wink of sleep. Kate tried everything. She researched online, changed rooms, worked out to exhaust herself, took supplements and meditated, but sleep wouldn't come.
I'm not even entirely sure how that time passed, but I honestly just spent a lot of time just kind of like looking into the dark. You know that to eventually achieve any sleep, you're going to have to just lie there for some period of time. So you do a lot of persisting. You do a lot of just, okay, I'll just give it another half an hour of just like lying here and trying to breathe and relax and do that kind of thing. And that there, the hours just passed, and before you know it's the early hours in the morning.
Professor Greg Murray is the head of psychological sciences and statistics at the Swinburne University of Technology. He says young adolescent adults are one of the age groups most likely to report insomnia.
People in young adulthood are facing all sorts of stresses around identity, work, relationships, etc. So we often do see mental health problems arising in young adults, and insomnia is kind of one of those, just like an anxiety problem or a mood problem.
With Kate's anxiety, the more she thought about sleep, the worse it became.
That can become quite distressing because you start to hinge a bit too much of your well-being sometimes on sleep. And if you hinge too much of your just mental and physical well-being on how many nights of how many hours of sleep you've got in the past night, that's not really helpful at all.
One of the things we know is that people who have insomnia tend to firstly underestimate how much sleep they get and overestimate the negative consequences of not getting the sleep they want.
Professor Murray says the best interventions for sleep problems are psychological or behavioural, such as cognitive behavioural therapy or CBT.
When I talk to people, the public, about this, I say, we can guarantee ourselves a good night's sleep if we laugh a lot in the daytime. And it's very important to think about that sleep and wake are opposite sides of the same coin. And the important point about that, of course, is we can consciously control how we live in the daytime, whereas we actually have no conscious control over how well we sleep.
For Kate, sleeping medication was necessary, but earlier intervention may have prevented the need for this. Dorothy Brock is an emeritus professor of psychology at Victoria University and sleep psychologist with the Sleep Health Foundation. She agrees while there is a role for sleeping medication, non-pharmacological treatments like CBT are generally better for improving insomnia.
We know that they sort of work in the short term, but in the long term, it's a lot more hit and miss whether they continue to work. And we also know that if people can make the right changes to their lifestyle and to their behaviours and to their way that they think about sleep, we know that that sort of treatment package is actually more effective than sleeping tablets in the medium and the long term.
She says even after the stress of a trigger disappears, insomnia can remain.
So the insomnia has something that sort of perpetuates itself. It's as if you get a bit of a glitch and the insomnia just keeps going no matter what your other mental health status might be.
For Kate, this is very much the case. She still suffers from the after effects of her experience and says it has changed her perspective entirely.
There are absolutely worse places you can be than failing exams or failing all your exams or dropping out of uni or just all of those things become instantly trivial. You've got to have a new perspective. You've got to... It makes you fundamentally reevaluate the priority you put on everything.
So that was Good Night and Good Luck from Maxwell Rolley. May, what did you think?
Yeah, well, I loved the introduction to this piece where the two main talents introduce themselves. It felt very natural. The great thing about this documentary is the quality of the audio. It makes it really easy to listen to. He's incorporated face-to-face interviews and phone interviews, but it all just worked really well together. Not only is the quality of the audio great, but also the quality of who he chose to interview. So you've got the personal interview where Kate speaks really well and tells her story. And then you've also got the professionals in the field who add great value and insight into this topic.
So what's the next piece you've got up?
Yeah, so moving on to our next story that also isn't spoken about very often in the media or within society is on dwarfism. Bridget Sloan created this piece focusing on the story of two mothers who each have a son with achondroplasia. Bridget said that this was undoubtedly the most rewarding project she's ever done for a university assignment, due to the fact that she loved that these families were trying to raise awareness. She also said that the mothers she interviewed gave her really personal information, most of which she didn't use in this documentary, but that feeling of having a stranger give her such personal details was really special. Let's have a listen to Bridget Sloan's story, called Standing Tall for Dwarfism.
Hi, What does every parent hope for their child's future? Good health, happiness, kindness, and fairness. These are the things that Yarika Bales prays for every night for her son Quaden, who was diagnosed with achondroplasia, a common form of dwarfism, at just 3 days old. Now, as Quaden starts his first year of school, Yarika fears for what struggles are to come.
It's every parent's worst nightmare to know that their child is suffering in silence. You know, they don't want to talk about it. And the bullying and, you know, the suicide, it's something that families with dwarfism cannot escape because it's an obvious physical difference. They are an easy target.
Another mum that can relate to the fear of sending her child with achondroplasia to school is Journey Casabuena, whose son Luca is now in grade 3.
That first year, it was a learning curve because people weren't sure of us. You know, people treat you obviously very different and they don't want to step on any toes. So it was just trying to find our feet.
As Journey also has achondroplasia, her son's diagnosis was easy to accept. But for Yarika and her partner, Quaden was the one in 25,000 children born with dwarfism to parents without the condition.
So I was so broken and shattered and depressed with the diagnosis. I was just in shock and I hid it from the world. You know, I pretty much hid him from the world for 2 years because I was so scared. It was the fear of the unknown.
Starting her own campaign for awareness, called Stand Tall for Dwarfism, has been instrumental for Yarika in raising Quaden and accepting his diagnosis.
That was just my way of reaching out. It was a cry for help, really, because I just had no idea, like, what to expect. And then when we started getting all the negative attention in public, turning, to the worldwide short stature community around the world, they helped me raise Quaden, and still are to this day, because, you know, I can go off their advice and their lived experiences where there's generations of people with dwarfism in their family. So it's been the most amazing tool.
Today, Stand Tall for Dwarfism's Facebook page has over 8,000 likes and is growing, which Yarika says is all down to the love and motivation she receives from her son.
He inspired this whole new campaign, which is so much more because it's because I shared my story and I was reaching out in frustration that so many more people now know about dwarfism and know that midget isn't the acceptable term. And it's only because I had the courage to speak out and share my story, which was a really hard thing to do.
Journey is also using her and Luca's story to educate Australians through her daily blog, which documents a day in her life.
Living with dwarfism, being a mum of a child with dwarfism, and sharing my story from the perspective of having dwarfism so that people who obviously don't know very much about it, they can learn and they can be maybe a little bit more empathetic.
Raising awareness is so important to both Journey and Yarika to build a better world for their sons, free of hate both online and in life.
The goal is to make it a more loving and accepting world for him to grow up in and not feel inferior, which is what he's feeling at the moment. He's very self-conscious. He doesn't like looking at himself in the mirror. He doesn't like taking photos with other kids. And then when he does, he'll look back on it and he just looks at himself in a not-so-nice way. And it's so heartbreaking as a parent because to us, he's just Quaden and he's the coolest kid. He's so funny and, you know, but then he's got this really sensitive side, an emotional side where he'll cry. And
Yarika can't deny, however, that Quaden's physical health is the main thing that keeps her up at night.
He is in severe pain to the point where he's actually said, "I just want to die." You know, and to hear your five-year-old child even say that is, oh, man, I just had to just, I was choking back tears.
To deal with such heartbreaking moments, both mums have admitted to seeking help from the Short Statured People of Australia organisation, or SSPA, specifically from Brisbane representative Tanea Shannon.
SSPA has been a non-profit organisation for 49 years. Like, next year, 50 years is our thing, and we have conferences every year, so that's like 1 week of doctors and sports and dance and trivia and sports weekends every year.
And thankfully, Luca and Quaden, only 1 year apart in age, will always have each other for support.
Our sons are, you know, like they actually call each other brothers. They're more than friends and they've been really good for each other.
Bridget Sloan reporting for Jack Radio.
So we just listened to Standing Tall for Dwarfism by Bridget Sloan. Dan?
Look, the amazing thing about this story is the way that Yerrika Bales, the first mum that we heard from in that piece, has really embraced her son's dwarfism as a way to empower her child and the children of others with the condition. Her work with Dwarfism Awareness Australia means she can use her own practical experience to help other parents who might be struggling if their children have the same thing. The way Bridget pieces story together shows how moving those realities of parenthood can be and why these types of radio pieces are so important. That really is the power of radio, I guess. It's letting Yerrika tell her story in her own words, in her own way, and it lets her know that there are people listening to what she's saying. Bridget's piece here is also a good way to give us some perspective on our own lives and to be a little bit more conscious of the things that we have and the people that we are and how we see and recognise difference in other people.
Yeah. So the next story you have for us has a different feel. What's it about?
It certainly does. It's a slight change of pace now to a crossover between art, modelling and theatre that has experienced a rapid growth and significant presence in pop culture since the early 1990s. Cosplay is not merely dressing up in comic book costumes, but a very unique form of performance art. It's most widely associated with comic books, anime, video games, and cosplay conventions are becoming increasingly mainstream. In fact, the Supernova Convention will visit 6 major Australian cities this year. For some, the cosplay subculture isn't just about dressing up. Well-known performers attract huge audiences and substantial pay packets. Top-tier cosplayers can earn in excess of $100,000 a year just through appearance fees and merchandise sales. Kel Anderson speaks to some amateur cosplayers about their processes, their motivations, and their inspirations. This next piece goes inside the world of cosplay, where preparations for these events begin long before the convention doors open.
When I interviewed Theo Wilson, the first thing we spoke about was Fire Emblem. It's a strategy video game series that he and I both really enjoy. This becomes important later. But first, let's take it back a few steps to before I sat down to formally interview him. He's hunched over a sewing machine.
So that features hand-sewn hem. This skirt took me about 11 hours.
Despite what you may think, Theo isn't a tailor or a dressmaker. He's a cosplayer. And in the world of cosplay, he goes by the name Suitsuki. Cosplay, short for costume roleplay, is the art of making and dressing up in costumes which represent fictional characters. For some people, this isn't just a hobby. Indeed, for Theo, it's hopefully a career.
I think since I started cosplaying, I've always wanted to have my name, you know, on a convention website, like, this cosplayer is coming, come and see them, and have people want to come and see me. I want to be able to make money off this. I want to be able to live off this. It's like a dream, you know.
This isn't as far-fetched a goal as it might seem. Like Theo says, famous cosplayers like Reika and Elodia are paid hefty sums to make appearances at cosplay conventions. Jessica Nagiri, another popular cosplayer, receives around $25,000 in fan donations every month. Clearly, there's a market for professional cosplay, and it's a market Theo wants to break into. He's currently preparing for the Australian preliminaries of the World Cosplay Summit in August. Remember that strategy game, Fire Emblem, I spoke about earlier? Well, Theo and his partner will be cosplaying as Takumi and Mikoto, two characters from that game.
By choosing these two characters, I had to make skirts, I had to do waistbands, do zippers, do corsets. I chose things that I feel would challenge me and also show off the skills that I'm gaining along the way.
Theo has wanted to pursue professional cosplay for a long time now, but he recalls a specific experience which sparked the passion. He was cosplaying as Hiccup, a character from the How to Train Your Dragon movies.
I went to a convention in Brisbane. It was quite a small one, and I had to walk from the train station to there. So I'm walking through the valley, and all these kids, like, there's a kid across the road, and I was like, it's Hiccup! Being recognised is probably one of the greatest things that can happen to you as a cosplayer.
But what actually goes into the process of making one of these costumes? How much time and money and effort? Well, I asked Koba Arfius. He's another cosplayer who goes by the name Blunt Legion. Incidentally, he's a friend of Theo's. They met through cosplay.
Yeah, it can take anything from like a week to months and months, depending on how much you want to detail the costume.
Koba's process is remarkably specific and refined.
I find what I want to cosplay first and then write like all the elements of the costume down, like break it down into like what materials for like what I need. Like, I need boots, and I need material to cover those boots. And then I need, like, pleather for a bodysuit, and then I need, like, gold for detailing. So just, like, break down the cosplay, find what elements I need, find those elements, buy all of them, and then just stare at the fabric for a month.
And then, once the costume's done, it's packed up and transported to a convention where it'll be shown off, entered into competitions, and sometimes even performed in. Conventions are a pretty major part of the cosplay experience. This is what they sound like.
And now let's welcome the Vesperman sisters as Yang and Ruby from Ruby.
Jen Berry is another cosplayer. She goes by the name Nifty Nuts Cosplay. She's also a friend of Theo's, and you guessed it, they met through cosplay. She says that conventions like these are all about meeting new people and bonding over your shared love of pop culture.
Conventions bring everyone together. In normal everyday life, people will probably find cosplayers a bit weird. So it's just a place where you can bond with the people that are sort of like you. And it's also another thing of being excited over it and seeing if other people are excited about it.
For Theo, all of this holds true, but the real joy for him comes from making something that both he and other people can appreciate.
I think the appeal for me is seeing how it ends up looking. Finishing something and putting it on and looking in the mirror and going, oh my god, I made this. I get to make things that my favourite character has worn and essentially become my favourite character. So I guess that's really the appeal for me, is like I get to be somebody else for a day and I get to make that and see people look at it and go, wow, that's awesome.
Earlier on, I mentioned that the first thing Theo and I spoke about was a video game franchise that we both love. I said this was important. And the reason I said it was important is that I think it gets to the heart of what cosplay is really about. Using the pop culture you love as a way to connect with other people. Or as Theo puts it,
even if I don't win any of these competitions, or even if I don't enter like at all, I'm still having a great time, you know? I'm still making things that I love. It's about the friendships we made along the way. You know, that whole stupid thing, but like it's what it is, you know. Even if you don't make it to the top, you've made so many great friends.
That last piece was from Kel Anderson. Maya, what did you think?
Yeah, well, this was a really nice piece and it was extremely well structured. To be honest, I didn't really think that I'd be interested in a cosplay story, but I have been proven wrong. It was a nice light piece and to me, it sounded just the way a radio documentary should. I think this is because Kel told the story. He used sound and introduced the talent seamlessly. I'm really impressed.
All right, now I believe another change of pace, we're going offshore for this next story.
We are going offshore. The next story we have is by Morgan Orton, and she tells the story of an elderly couple who decided to sail around the world and met some unlikely visitors along the way. Let's have a listen.
The boat was sitting like a painted ship on a painted ocean. The colours of the water sort of faded into blue, and you couldn't tell where the horizon was. It got to be hot in the afternoon, and we put a rope on and jumped into the water for a swim, and the water was 10,000 metres deep, and it's a sort of a spooky feeling, you know, like when you look over the balcony of a 40-storey hotel, but then the dolphins come and they're stopping beside you and just lying there, and I don't like that. It's great.
Don Amel is 74 years old, and he's a sailor. Instead of settling down into a comfortable retirement, Don and his then wife did what to many of us would be unthinkable. They sold up and set sail for the oceans of the world.
It took 60,000 miles to sail because we zigzagged, and I think we visited 60 countries and took 12 years. Going from a corporate job, there was always stress on, we've got to do this. But when you sail away, it all stops.
Margaret and Brian Hallwell set sail around the same time as Don, from Melbourne. The Hallwells travelled up through Europe and Asia.
Sailed up the coast, stayed in this area for two or three years, didn't we?
I was getting a bit bored with doing same old. We might as well be retired in a house. So we sailed around the world.
Not to forget their creature comforts, they even picked up a cat along the way.
The cat? Yeah, we found the cat quite by accident. A friend of ours was walking his dog ashore one day, and the dog went off and picked up this kitten that was the only one alive out of a dumped litter and brought it back. We probably unwisely decided we'd keep the cat. Nearly lost her over the side a couple of times when we were sailing.
You have a proper ship's cat?
We do.
We do now, yeah, she's the boss.
Do you think you'll ever leave the boat?
We'll live here until they take us out in our box, I suppose, then. Because this is our retirement home.
Don, Margaret and Brian all now live on their boats in Kiwanis Waters Marina. Fiona Moyer, who has worked there for 14 years, has seen hundreds like them.
A lot of the people seem to be a little bit left of field, I suppose. No, I suppose we're all a little bit that way, but...
Would you do it? Would you sell up and sell around the world?
I mean, maybe everybody sort of has that dream, don't they? Like, to just jump on a boat. Sailing, I don't know. I don't think I'd want to be in the middle of the ocean for days and days and days on end. You know, if something happens, there's a big storm or you break down, you're not able to access help.
Don Amel also mentions the dangers that he has encountered in the past.
Crossing the Indian Ocean down to Madagascar. Every day the wind got stronger and stronger and the waves built up and built up and the waves are huge. We were picked up by a big wave and dropped sideways down into the wave with a great crash. We started to think this is a bit ordinary, and things started to break. But when it breaks, you fix it.
So what makes a sailor then?
You've got to be a Dick Smith type person, willing to accept the risk. Be confident that you can fix it yourself or you can cope.
And was it worth it?
Oh God, yes. And it's very satisfying to do it. I mean, people see it all on television, but to go yourself and see it and to cross 3,000 miles of ocean and take 3 weeks to do it and get exactly where you want to go is very satisfying.
What I really want to know is, why do you do it? When you come to a new country, you have no car, you have to stay with the boat, it can be dangerous, and you're often without contact with other people for weeks at a time. Why did you choose to sail instead of retiring to a house?
If you live in a house and you don't know your neighbours very well, it's just you and your family, that's different. I mean, everyone we meet is a potential best friend. If you don't like where you are in a boat, if you don't like the neighbours, if you don't like the people, you move. Just go. Most of my family say, you're mad. Why do you do this? But we go to places where the tourists don't go, and we live with the people there, whether they're Fijians or Hindus or Muslims. We never found anyone that wasn't absolutely wonderful.
It seems the sailing life might not be for everyone, but for people like Don, Margaret and Brian, it's enough for them.
An amazing story. What are your thoughts?
Well, they're definitely an adventurous couple. It sounds like they're making the most of their retirement.
It does. I would love to do what they're doing.
All right, well, we're going to slow things down again now. Most of us are at home each night with food on our tables, but there is a whole population that doesn't have that luxury. Mia Knight tells this story.
It's another cold autumn's night in Ipswich, but today is Tuesday, which means the Ipswich Helping Hands van and its volunteers will be out in full force. But they have few blankets to give out tonight, and the cooler weather is starting to set in.
It's getting colder, guys, so we're not going to put jumpers and blankets out, but if someone comes up and asks, just point them to somebody who's been here a bit, we'll get them out for them specifically.
20-year-old university student Ryan Baker regularly comes out on the van to help out. He says that the most important thing the van offers is the interaction with other members of the community.
Getting to interaction with people is so mentally healthy for them.
Mr. Richard Condon co-founded the Christian-based charity in 2009 and for the past 7 years has delivered food, drinks and company to those doing it tough.
Hostel living is a pretty rough life. We try to help them just by providing extra bits and pieces of food. And there's a few guys in there that we've really got to know that we try to really encourage them in the struggles they go through, particularly with health issues and things like that.
One of those struggling with health issues is Barry, a regular at Denmark Guest House, who is well known to Ryan and the other volunteers.
So Barry doesn't have use of one of his arms, so you just got to help him carry stuff.
You not feeling too good tonight?
Just be careful where you walk.
You're just tired? All right, I got some people in here. We got some soup and some bread.
You walk through the doorway, adorned with hanging beads and bells, into Barry's room.
Well, I'm back here 19 and a half years on the 30th of July.
Beyond the doorway, it's hard to tell where the room begins and ends. The walls and most of the floor are covered inch to inch with trinkets, soaps, candles and Christmas decorations.
I like collecting, decorating and aromatherapy.
Aromatherapy.
Yeah.
Very nice.
It changes the whole mood.
Changes your whole mood.
He clearly appreciates the work that the food van does.
What do you think of the food van?
It's absolutely awesome.
The second stop is outside of the CWA Ladies Hostel, the busiest stop of the night, says Richard, with often around 30 to 40 people coming out for the van.
People living in cars who know that we're going to pull up there on a Tuesday night, and they come for as much food as they can get. And we try to provide as much as we can for them that have donated to us. Surprisingly, we get some families with young ones who come along and who are really struggling, and they get their kids' lunches for the week from us. So it's a pretty busy stop.
James and Nikki are currently in between homes, waiting for approval on a house. They live in their car and rely on the van for a good meal every Tuesday, as well as other essential supplies.
Most weeks they have toiletries and other stuff, but that's the priority. It's a great service for the community, that what they do, yeah. It's really good.
Some people come here for the company as well, like just to socialise, yeah. And other people do it because they really have to. The whole mixture of people.
Another regular for the food van is Stacey and her husband Graham, who live just next door to the CWA Ladies Hostel.
My unit's just down there with the light on.
Yeah.
This time I've got the walking stick with me.
All right, no more tripping over then for you. Whoa. Come on, we'll get you some food, okay, Stacey?
You can practically see the community spirit as everyone eats, chats and jokes. Laughter fills the otherwise empty road.
Anyone want sweet?
No, sweet enough.
Sweet enough?
I'm sweet enough.
You're sweet.
The third stop that the yellow doors of the Helping Hands van opens to is Lilliput Caring, a hostel for those with disabilities.
Now, these people are basically handicapped in some way, in different degrees. Some of them are physically handicapped and some of them are intellectually handicapped or have had severe accidents.
Again, the van plays a very important role in the community, as Richard explains.
And we come here not because they're not looked after and they get enough food, but because they don't get interaction in the community. And what they really want, Lily, who runs this place, is to get us to interact with people and chat with people and treat them like they're just normal, average people.
The van is completely reliant on donations and are 100% non-for-profit, but even after 7 years of service are showing no signs of slowing down just yet.
That last piece was from Mia Knight. Mia, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I actually felt like I was there with Mia because she used that live sound throughout her package. That's different to anything that we've heard so far, so I really enjoyed it.
Hmm. Now, this last story is one that we both agreed on was just an amazing story.
Yes, we did. We both heard it and we both really enjoyed it. This final piece is very personal and it's told from a first-person perspective. Nazli Salami tells of her struggle with an eating disorder and the impact it had on her family. This package is very powerful. Let's have a listen.
Once upon a time, the food court was one of the most frightening and intimidating places that I could be in. This is the sound of the food court where I threw up and collapsed 7 years ago. I still remember the pained look on my mother's face as she frantically force-fed her teenage daughter orange juice from the nearest candy store. The last thing I remember is being wheelchaired by complete strangers to the doctor downstairs. My name is Nazli. When I was 15, I battled the beast that is an eating disorder. Today, I woke up a healthy, happy 22-year-old. But of the 9% of Australians who have an eating disorder, 1 in 10 never wake up again. I know firsthand just how little is done to help people like me in Australia. It was like everyone around me knew what was going on, but gave it a blind eye. The only help I did get was being referred to the school counsellor and then a dietitian. That was it. No question of how I was feeling inside, despite the fact that eating disorders are a mental illness. So I fought alone for a long, long time. In my own city of Brisbane, the Centre for Integrative Health was set up 2 years ago. It was founded by Dr. Kira Buchanan. Kira is a clinical and health psychologist. She directs the centre. Frustrated by the current healthcare system, she decided something needed to be done.
What we've been particularly passionate about is trying to educate people around how eating disorders are like a physical, medical health condition as well as a mental and emotional condition as well. So practitioners need to, but often don't, have an understanding of what's going on for the person from a physical, medical perspective, as well as what's going on for them psychologically, and the two components needing to be addressed.
For me, seeing a dietitian helped get my physical health back on track, but my family had to pay for every cent. I think that's unfair. If it were up to me, I wouldn't be there to begin with. Dietitian Kate Pollard from the Centre for Integrative Health understands.
They may be able to have access to an enhanced primary care plan, which means that they can have a very small rebate for a maximum of 5 sessions. And not all of my clients or their doctors are aware that they're able to be eligible for that.
I can tell you that an eating disorder is a truly complex mental illness. Maybe that's why I felt like no one around me understood.
There's still lots of myths and misconceptions about an eating disorder, that it's, you know, something that people will grow out of, or it's something that they're doing for attention. So I suppose, what I'm saying is they're quite complicated, and the complexity of them isn't really well understood by the general public or by even a lot of health practitioners.
This is why I think it's just so important to treat people early and properly. I suffered depression, anxiety, and obsessive compulsive disorder for years after the physical side effects were gone. I shouldn't have had to. I finally decided myself to see someone a couple of years ago. I'm just lucky to be seeing the light now.
I definitely think that eating disorders should be like a specialised area of treatment. So you should need to have specialist training in order to be able to deliver treatment to someone with an eating disorder, because lots of people with an eating disorder might not get the right treatment and their condition is worsened or is maintained for much longer than what it needs to be.
When I sought help with a psychologist, I was granted cover by Medicare. At the time, mental health sessions could be covered for 6 to 18 sessions. I was lucky. It's not like that anymore. Now there is a flat-out 10-session rule. It doesn't matter who you are or what you're suffering from. Marita Cooper, who is the other clinical and health psychologist at the Centre for Integrative Health, can see that this is a problem.
It's not enough. Our typical course of treatment for bulimia or binge eating disorder is a minimum of 20 sessions, depending on the extra factors, it could be up to 40 sessions. And when we're looking at anorexia, we've got a minimum 6-month but often 12-month course of treatment.
I think there's hope. The first ever World Eating Disorders Action Day is happening tomorrow. The Butterfly Foundation for People with Eating Disorders is currently running its May Day campaign. And then there's people like Kira, Kate and Marita, who are beacons of hope. But it's a game of snakes and ladders. It was announced recently that funding for the Butterfly Foundation is only secured for another year. They run the only national hotline for people with eating disorders in Australia. I just hope that won't be the case.
That was Nazli Salami with her powerful and personal story on eating disorders. Dan?
Look, this is such a heartbreaking and brutally honest story. Nazli's willingness to put a story out there, it really is a beacon of hope for people who may be going through something similar now. As she points out in her piece, an eating disorder isn't a condition that exists in a vacuum. They contribute to and they're amplified by other factors like depression and stress and anxiety. It also really shines a light on the Australian health system, I guess, and the difficulty in getting access to funds for conditions that may be less visible, less prominent than other medical problems. It isn't something that affects just the individual. The effects can be felt across their family and their friends. It's really important there are supports out there for those people as well. The Butterfly Foundation, Nazli mentioned in her story, has a wealth of information online for young people and their families, and that includes access to support services. And you can find them online at thebutterflyfoundation.org.au. That is all we have time for today on Jack Radio. Thanks so much for joining Maya and myself. The documentaries we've listened to today are just a small sample of the amazing work done by Journalism in Sound students here at the University of Queensland. Many hours of time and effort have gone into producing some amazing documentaries. We'd also like to thank Bruce Woolley and Casey Fung for their guidance and support through the semester, and Anthony Frangie for his teaching and production support as well. Audio journalism is in a state of flux, with on-demand podcasts rapidly gaining popularity. Broadcast radio is changing the way it speaks to people, needing to quickly adapt to changing lifestyles and the innumerable ways we can consume content. There will always be one constant, though. Audio journalism will forever be about the stories and the voices of regular people, just like you and I. I'm Daniel Seed. Thank you so much for joining us here today on Jack Radio.